I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with designer Innie Archibong, who currently is at work on his first architectural project, an African diaspora pavilion for the London Design Biennale in 2021. His wide range of clients include Logitech, Hermes, and Knoll.
Innie is also a strategic consultant in the luxury sports, hospitality, music, and technology sectors. His work has been featured in exhibitions at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and most recently in the exhibition Speechless, co-organized by the Dallas Museum of Art and Atlanta's High Museum of Art.
The son of Nigerian parents who came to the United States as academic scholars, Innie grew up in California, has lived in Asia, and is currently based in Switzerland, where he's a visiting professor at Ecole. He's a true citizen of the world, something we'll certainly be talking with him about on this episode. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Innie. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Spencer. Good to be here.
So, other than opening a bottle of wine, what's on the top? What is on the top of your mind right now?
I thought we were going to keep the bottle of wine secret. What's on the top of my mind right now? This podcast and cleaning my apartment. That's top of the mind. But I guess that's not very interesting, is it?
Well, you're talking to us from Neuchâtel in Switzerland, where you live and work. What's it been like there during COVID? How's your life been during this period?
It hasn't been so bad. I feel terrible saying that, especially to people living in the U.S. right now. You know, Switzerland is a very particular type of place. It's I guess, the type of place where you would want to be during a pandemic. Mm. Most of the people follow the rules or the suggestions because they wouldn't impose rules on people. So I also live in a very small town. So, you know, our numbers weren't high and Swiss people in general keep 6 feet apart at all times of year. At least from me.
Well, for you, at least from what I understand, Neuchâtel's always been kind of this like quiet refuge, a place to have focus and kind of push yourself creatively, be able to actually get really good creative work done. Could you talk to us about how you think about isolation and introspection, both in this COVID context, but also in terms of your own approach to life and work?
Yeah, I think that for some people, it's really important to make sure that you give yourself distance and space from other people, you know, at least the opportunity to have distance from other people. For me personally, it's really important because I grew up with like a pretty extreme, I guess, attention problem, they would say. I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was like 11 or 12. I've always had my own way of learning and doing things. And it took me probably about 23, 24 years before I figured out how to really harness what they would call a disability, what I call a superpower, what I would need to do to make it so that I could have like ultra focus and complete tasks really efficiently and effectively. So part of that is isolating myself, honestly, like eliminating the potential for distraction and giving myself like a pretty strict regimen routine, you know, that extends all the way down to like the foods that I eat and everything else. Everything is pretty regulated. So Neuchâtel is kind of perfect for that. Plus I have a lake view out my window.
I wanted to bring up your life as like sort of a true citizen of the world. You had Nigerian immigrant parents. You're born and raised in the U.S. You've lived in Asia. You're now in Europe. What do you think about this citizen of the world idea?
It's funny to call it an idea. I think it's just like a reality that we choose to ignore. You know, we're all citizens of the world, and the boundaries, that's what's delusional. You know, it's like, that's the idea. The idea are the boundaries and the flags. But like, the reality is that, you know, we're all part of like a giant web of interconnectedness that we cannot escape. Mm-hmm. We can try to deny because we think that it'll help our own personal interests move forward. But the fact of the matter is none of us can move forward without the rest. So for me, you know, I grew up in a pretty, you could call small city, Pasadena. And I didn't move out of Pasadena until I was 29 years old. So, you know, I didn't plan to live anywhere else until I did. And I think the perspective that I just expressed, you know, I had that perspective when I left, and it made it so that it's never been uncomfortable for me to move to a place where I don't speak the language or into a foreign culture and adapt. It allows me to be pretty open-minded and do my best to be empathetic with the culture and the people that I encounter. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I've been welcomed everywhere I've been. Mm. I mean, the most unwelcoming place I've ever lived was America, actually. Just funny to think about.
In the context of the sort of notion of citizen of the world, you're currently working on your first architectural project, an Africa diaspora pavilion for the London Design Biennial. Could you share with us how this came about and how you're approaching it, what your vision for it is?
Yeah, I guess it technically started in Cape Town, South Africa, when I was a speaker at Design Indaba. And S. Devlin, who is like literally a hero of mine from the time I was in school, like the first stage that she did for Kanye West was cemented her as like a legend to me.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She was also a speaker there. I think she was like the big speaker for that year. I hadn't even met her. I gave my talk and she started a standing ovation in the theater and then came to me afterward. You know, we connected, exchanged info, and she told me that she was moved by my talk, and you know, we stayed in touch. So fast forward, I guess a year and a half, maybe a year, we had connected again a couple of times in London, and then she got named the artistic director of the Design Biennale in London, and she rang me up. You know, she told me she wanted me to be involved. What was interesting is that she wanted me to be involved, but she didn't know which country I would represent. So we basically started there. I went to London and visited her studio. And, you know, she explained what she was thinking and what the theme was. And, you know, my brain started clicking kind of right there. But then when it came to the topic of country, it was really clear to me that that was the only possible hindrance for me to participate. You know, I am appreciative of people celebrating culture. Small community cultures are very important, but the idea of representing like a flag that covers so many people that are so diverse and so different, you know, didn't necessarily sit right with me. Even though I'm very proud to be Nigerian, I'm very proud to have grown up in the United States, I don't feel like I represent the United States, you know, especially not at this, where it is right now, you know. And then thinking about Nigeria, I have Nigerian heritage, but I didn't grow up there. I'm not there right now. So I would never want to take the opportunity from somebody who's, you know, a practicing architect or designer that lives and grew up in you know, in Nigeria. And then, you know, the idea of representing Switzerland seemed like it was going to be an uphill battle in itself, even though Switzerland is actually very supportive of the designers that are coming from outside waving the Swiss flag for them. But, you know, because of all those things, that night I just thought about it and I really kind of in self-reflection was like, well, who do I identify with? And being, as you say, a citizen of the world, you know, one thing that is clear is no matter what country I'm in, I feel a sense of kinship, safety, and a feeling of home whenever I find the area where there are a lot of Black people. Mm. And that to me is something that I know is common for not just Black Americans, but Black people around the world, regardless of where they come from, that there's a sense of comfort when you see others like yourself. So for me, that was when I realized that the nation that I would represent would be the nation of the African diaspora, because, you know, that is what encompasses all of us. That is what all of us share as a home, is the fact that at some point, you know, we were displaced, whether by choice or by force, from, you know, the grounds where we came from. And then even beyond that, you know, we talk about the diaspora in the sense of being taken from Africa or leaving Africa and going out into the world. But, you know, Africa is a very large continent. So you have to think that in the sense of the essence of the word diaspora, you know, as soon as you venture out of your own local village or area or city or any of those things, you're displaced. There's a huge difference between the village where my mother grew up and Somalia, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the streets in Addis are all named other African countries. you know, Swaziland Avenue and things. I mean, yeah. Recognizing that people travel there.
Yeah, it's a different way of looking at it. And that's basically how it happened. I mean, she loved the idea. Mm. Also, it's funny, we weren't yet in the place where we are now, right?
Right.
Because this was like, I guess, 2018 or 19, right, that we had this conversation. You know, now it's like a poignant topic that everybody's talking about. Back then, it wasn't that big of a topic, but for me, it had always been a big topic, you know, feeling this sense of lack of roots holding me anywhere, right? So for S and I, the reason that it was pretty strong, I think, is because within the theme of resonance, you know, it was a very clear way to express something that we both felt was important, an important message to the world that, you know, even though during these biennales, we have all of these creatives representing where they're from, there's also this idea that there can exist a resonant frequency that resonates across borders.
Yeah. And it seems to extend the idea of what place is.
Yeah.
When we're looking at it from a curatorial perspective. So it's actually really pushing forward the whole arena of what a biennale can be.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And I think the idea of the diaspora is really topical, not just within Africa, but there are religions that discuss diaspora. There's
exactly.
A sense of identity of diaspora in place that needs to be brought into these sort of situations, because it becomes nationalistic almost when you have a biennale. So you're responding to that as a medium, which is cool. As a designer, it's not that you have a role to serve society or that you have to work for anyone, but there's opportunity there, right? And this is a great example of it. What are some of the other ways you're thinking about how design can find opportunity in current issues, you know, climate crisis, social unrest, food shortages, things like this?
My approach to solving any of these issues, for me personally, I think that my skill set is best aimed at attacking the root. Mm. And the root is a lack of understanding of a sense of connectedness to everything in existence, period. Because once you feel that, then you see yourself as a piece of a larger body, then it kind of finds a way to solve all of those problems. You no longer look at yourself as separated from the person standing next to you. You no longer think that you can like hurt a tree in order to benefit yourself. You know, you can't hurt anything to benefit you. If you hurt anything, you're hurting yourself. So, you know, whether it's climate change or nationalism or police brutality, whatever it is, you know, it's this shift in like the global consciousness that I think is going to end up being what potentially allows the human race to continue to enjoy existing here. Otherwise, like the rest of the universe is going to be like, hey, you guys are fucking up. Get out of here. Which is basically what we're watching. You know, we're not experiencing us damaging anything. We're experiencing us like committing a slow suicide for our entire race.
Yeah. And being put on trial by nature.
Exactly.
In a way. So I'm also interested in how varied your practice is. How you define designer is interesting. I mean, you draw on lots of different ways to express ideas.
Yeah.
And you're interested in building a studio, like a collective kind of practice.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear a bit from you about the moment we're in right now and how you personally and possibly collectively within your practice things are changing. Things are moving forward. This is not the 90s of design, you know? Thank God.
Yeah, that stuff is funny looking. Yeah, I don't know. I think the collective idea, to me, it just makes sense. I think what we've seen within the design industry is we've seen that like the cult of celebrity, you know, all of this stuff entering into the design space, the media being an important part of like any industry in order to keep it like financially lubricated, you could say, has turned it into a thing where the most optimal way to get to the destination that we would like to go to has been put aside for a lot of times personal interests, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea of like a singular visionary, that individual and that archetype is important in order to lead collective efforts. But the idea of just kind of disseminating products with a name on it just because of its ability to sell because of the name that's attached to it is something that started to really grab hold within design. And it's great because it made it possible for there to be designer millionaires and for us to see some pretty visionary stuff from very talented people. But I think that its true purpose was to show us that there is the potential for design voices to have an impact beyond the sphere of the local design community, right? And now that we know that that's possible, I feel like from my standpoint, my responsibility is to take it to the next level. And for me, the next level is using that ability to have a voice to find the others of like capability and put them in a position to cultivate their ability to develop their voice for how they can benefit the rest of humanity and for us to work together with each other to do our best work. Mm. With the collective that I'm starting, I can't even call it my studio because like everybody's a lot younger than me. So A, they're cooler. B, they're more in tune. C, they've got a whole bunch of skill set that like I don't have. And my goal isn't to like use them as CAD monkeys. So at some point they're going to understand the way that industry works well enough that they're going to come up with ideas and I'm probably going to end up working for them on some of the projects, you know? Yeah. They're going to say, Eni, you're good at this, so can you work on this part of this project?
Which represents a real shift because, I mean, we're coming out of a period where there was this opportunity for designers to sort of be elevated culturally.
Yeah.
But then the hubris set in and you had a lot of people tripping over themselves.
Yeah.
And there's all this lost opportunity because they're not actually applying, you know, intention on things. Yeah. They're elevating personal brand.
Yeah.
They essentially became, you know, a Hollywood version that doesn't have the same effect. And what's funny is outside of the design world, which is microscopic.
Yeah.
No one knows.
Nobody knows who we are. Nobody gives a shit who we are.
So it's this sort of like really funny thing, but which is why I think it's so extraordinary the way you're thinking about this, like how to have global impact is kind of getting over this idea of personal brand in a way.
Yeah.
And how do you collectively bring that forward?
Which is a hilarious paradox, right?
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason that like the whole Elemento Creative is a tongue-in-cheek acknowledgement of this paradox. It was actually my thesis when I graduated from Art Center. Mm. And that was 2012 when like this celebrity design thing was like full swing, you know?
Yeah.
And my whole thing was, what if you became famous in order to renounce your fame? Right?
Tough thing to do.
Totally. But yeah, it's almost like in order to grant credibility to the collective, somebody has to like go out there, be intrepid, and do a lot of things that have a positive impact so that the collective would then have opportunity and also have like a guidepost. You know, when I was in school, there was a few people that I was lucky to come in contact with that let me know like, oh, you can have like a really lofty aim that a lot of people would say is unrealistic and make it happen.
Yeah.
Tim Kobe was one of those people where even just being in a meeting where he was leading a meeting and just sitting in the back of the room as an intern and seeing how like the things that he would come up with and propose that would be easy to say that's unrealistic. For example, like you should sell Apple products in a retail space, right? End up becoming, you know, transformational. And then, you know, somebody who I always point to is like Kanye West, like watching him announce something unrealistic that everybody tells him he's crazy for thinking he can do, and then doing it, and then all of us looking back in retrospect and saying, wow, yeah, we really should listen to him when he said that he could design products.
Yeah, or Elon Musk, who's saying we can have electric cars. You know, these are the people we need.
Exactly. And, you know, and then I have my fictional heroes. I mean, the protagonists of all these stories, and like the Howard Rourke's and all of those, that type of stuff is big for me. Mm.
I wanted to continue around some of the social context stuff we've been talking about. And I was wondering, could you share your thoughts on Black Lives Matter and particularly the unrest that's happening during this election season from your perspective? Because as a Black man living overseas, who is American, but is kind of on the inside and the outside, who thinks about the world in the global interconnected way that you do, what are your views on the movement and on the election?
Part of me being me is that I do my best to not be political. I think that politics are one of the strongest weapons of the delusion that is here to distract us from what's really important. Mm. So I don't think that they're necessary, and I don't think that they are a positive part of society, honestly, because politics is just a show of it. Now, put all of that aside, and if we were to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement as a movement, mm-hmm. because a lot of people tend to lump everything into BLM. That's not the only movement. There's movement mm-hmm. for Black Lives. There's a lot of stuff going on out there. And I think that they are all important. I think that every single organization that is fighting for there to be space for the equal respecting of all different seeming groups is important and necessary. Mm. Because if their objectives manifest in the proper way, then I think that it will end up getting us to the point where we realize that there's really no separation between us, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that as antithetical as it might seem, the only way that we can get to a place where we look at each other and see what is similar before we see what's different is if we start to focus on how the people that have been the most hurt by seeming differences, you know, focus on what makes them particularly necessary for all of us to thrive. So, mm-hmm. you know, the idea that like Black Lives Matter is some kind of like cry for sympathies is insane to me. You know, it's not like, hey, come on, please, we matter. It's like, no, hey, check this out. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have us, you'd all be fucked.
Yeah. and I want to bring this up also in the context of Black culture, music, yeah. film, TV shows, sports, all the things that have this incredible influence around the world. How do you think about them in the context, in this context? And also just this idea of like, you know, being Black in quote white spaces.
The thing that's funny, I don't believe in scale and I don't believe in value. I think value is one of the greatest illusions and one of the best weapons of like the big delusion, right? Is the idea that like you can compare two things and one could have a higher value. I think that things have their own respective places, right? So I preface what I'm going to say with that so that it doesn't get misconstrued. Mm-hmm. I think that historically it has been shown that what we deem to be viscerally innovative on a deep core emotional level and novel, it would seem that it is something that is more readily accessible to some of us. And it's not to say that like Black people are the most creative, right? But you also have to take, I think, into consideration the fact that these expressions are coming from a place of oppression. So
and pain.
Exactly. The oppression and the pain creates, you know, a lot of these things. So when I say all those things about, you know, what potentially, you know, could be attributed to people of African descent, right? It's also, I don't know, because we're still looking at it through the lens of having been created under duress. So what's going to happen when everything is like smooth and clean and we're able to really parse out like where people are fitting in society? We might find out that actually, no, the reason that like most of our pro athletes are African Americans is because like they were genetically engineered to be really strong to work in the fields. Right. So you start to look at it and you say, OK, now we can put into perspective the things that happened in the past and we can start to see like things through the lens of reality and start to really say, wow, we've been separating people based on skin color when it's actually like personality types and archetypes that determine, you know, where people should be fitting in society. It's pretty crazy that when you think about it and you know, we're seeing a lot more people talking about like how trauma is passed down in the DNA and things of that nature. You know, to me, the real question is like, is it possible to get back to zero?
Or just to a new place? You know,
yeah.
The idea that by 2044, people of color will be the majority in America is a new platform. It's not zero. It's just a new platform and a new context.
Yeah. And are we ready for that?
It doesn't matter if we're ready for that. That is what it is. And that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You're approaching, I mean, not to put words in your mouth, but what I hear from you, which I think is novel, is a kind of new realism approach to the conversation, which is like, let's look at the reality.
The reality, yeah.
Yeah, and how context shapes people.
Yeah. And I have to be, honestly, I'm feeling very comfortable right now because like I've known Spencer for a long time. I don't usually necessarily talk about all this stuff publicly because I know that it can be misconstrued. A, B, it's also when we're talking about the stuff related to race, you also have to understand that there are within the Black community, there are different viewpoints of, you know,
nothing's monolithic.
Yeah. So yeah. Like,
and like your conversation would be really different if you weren't talking to two white guys.
Well,
like,
yeah. I mean,
that's the reality.
Yeah. Cause yeah, you don't want to hear the conversations I have with my brothers.
But you've previously spoken to me, Annie, about your Black privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts on that with the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit complicated, but, you know, with I think that when I talk about that privately, it's like I see it in two ways. I think that within the Black community, I'm always like very careful to be clear that I have had an experience of being Black in America that I can recognize how it can be viewed as privileged, right? And I can also recognize, because I'm very wary of saying that it is denotatively privileged, simply because people don't know what came before me. People don't know the story of, you know, like my father selling oranges at the train in Nigeria, but they don't know about, you know, my parents, the work that it takes to come from the village in Nigeria, not like the big city, and end up at Ivy League schools in the US and then start a family and then sacrifice everything. You know, like my parents sacrificed, I can't even think of anything that my parents ever did for themselves. I have no memory of anything that my parents ever did for themselves, right? In order for us to have this quote unquote privilege where, you know, they sacrificed everything to make sure that we could get the best education and all these things. So I always make sure to make a distinction to say, you know, as much hardship as my brothers and I went through, and as much as we weren't like wealthy, and, you know, as much as we struggled, and as much as, you know, growing up where we did in Pasadena, you know, we were, you know, in the midst of the stuff that happens north of the freeway, that even still, when I would go to my friend's house on El Sol and see what was going on at their house, I could tell that it was different at my house. And that's what I think I try to be clear about that type of privilege. I went to a prep school. My parents were very, very strict, you know, so a lot of things were avoided. Some of them they tried to help me avoid and I didn't avoid, but that's a different story. So that's one thing. And I don't talk about that as much. That's more of like a in the house conversation to me to get in depth. So I'll just leave it at that. But when I'm talking about it more publicly, I'm really talking about the fact that because of my approach and mentality since I was a kid, and because of the fact that I was pretty much an outcast in every community that I was in, but I was accepted by the close people that accepted me in those groups, I figured out a way to use my capacity for empathy to, you know, manage situations and bend them to my will. And due to that, when I am in completely white spaces, I know how to use the perceptions of me as a black man to put me in a position of privilege. And it doesn't always work out that way, but you know, there's a certain thing that happens when you're the only black person in the room if you maneuver it in a certain way. And because of the privilege that I had to be black in all white spaces at a young age, that put me in a position as an adult where, you know, I figured out how to have success in a design industry, for example, where there are not very many black people, you know, because I can figure out how to, it's not manipulating people's perceptions of me, but it is understanding what people's perceptions of me are, you know,
and owning your difference.
Yeah, completely owning my difference. But also there's, it's a double-edged sword, and it's something that, it's something that I accepted early on and I engaged in early on. I think I'm lucky that, you know, I was reading, you know, like the W.B. Du Bois and stuff like that when I was, I guess, pretty young, not that young, but like a teenager. And it had me thinking about, you know, like these things like dual perception and thinking about like the white gaze and all that stuff, so that it's not hard for me to read the room, you could say. A lot of people have said it before. I've written it down in various stages of my life, but the best way that I can help anyone, the best way that I can help my people, the best way that I can help anyone that I love is to first put myself in a position where I can operate from a place of safety. And then from a place of safety, then I can use my position to help. And, you know, everybody has their own path in their own way. But yeah, my black privilege allowed me to be in positions and in situations and to know how to navigate them in a way that have allowed me the benefit of what I have now. And the benefit of what I have now, honestly, I have the support of people that understand, you know, my objectives and understand who I am and what I am about, and allow me to create from that place where I don't need to fit into any molds. I can just be myself and create. And I can also create for the purposes that I deem credible. I don't have to water down anything anymore. It's a freedom.
What's given you the most hope as we go through this, as we emerge out of this pandemic?
What's giving me hope? This wine, baby. I think what's giving me hope, honestly, and it's not even a surprise, but it's the younger people. And I think it's the fact that I have a 3-year-old daughter. You know, her earliest memories are going to be about wearing a mask and dealing with COVID. No matter where we go from here, her perception of, like, if she sees differences in people, she's like, there are people that wear masks and there are people that don't. She's not like, there are black people and white people, there are yellow people, whatever. She's like, oh, some people wear masks, some people don't wear masks. It's really, she's starting from the standpoint where the first time she's able to cognize what she went through, she's going to realize, wait a second, I was born into a moment where there was an attempt at a collective effort towards saving everybody. And that's some hope, you know?
That's a hopeful note. Thanks, Vinny. This was so great to have you on today. Appreciate the generosity with your thoughts, and look forward to our next conversation.
Me too.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.